The following is the 11th lecture in this series on the Book of Genesis given at the Jewish Center on December 29th, 1960. Well, we're up to Noah today on page 9. Let's go, before we start going in detail to comparisons, to analyses, let's go over very quickly what the story is. This is the 10th generation since Adam. We read that, meanwhile, the world had been degenerating. There was the B'nai HaElohim, which we discussed last week, and then general God's regret that he had created man. Now we come to the story of Noah, who was a righteous man, but who lived in a corrupt generation, a generation filled with chumas, whatever that may mean. Let's translate it generally as evil. God decides to destroy the world through a flood. He tells Noah to build himself an ark, gives him the dimensions of the ark, gives him 120 years to do it. Meanwhile, he tells him to bring in the various animals, two of all other kinds of the kosher animals, to bring in seven. By kosher, I mean the tahor, the pure animals. Because then there was no problem of kashrus insofar as eating is concerned. Then a behema tahora meant an animal that was worthy of sacrifice. The significance of that we'll see later on too. He comes in with his three sons and his family. Then the heavens open up. The rain comes down for 40 days and 40 nights while they are inside the ark. The Mabul lasts 40 days upon the earth, raises them above the earth. It's 15 cubits high. All life dies except for the fish, of course. And the water increases in strength for 150 days. Then God remembers Noah. The heavens close, the windows of heaven close, which means the rain stops. At the end of 150 days, the waters begin to recede. The ark lands on Mount Ararat. At the end of 40 days afterwards, after the tips of the mountains are seen, Noah opens, I'm going over this story even though you know it, just to give you the outlines again. Noah opens the window of the ark, sends out a raven. The raven is not decisive. He isn't sure about it. He sends out afterwards again. That is, the raven goes and comes back. Then he sends out a dove. The dove has nothing. Then he sends out a dove again, and this time the dove brings back an olive branch. He knows that at least there's a chance for that the earth is beginning to blossom, returning a little bit to normal, but he can't get out yet because had there been place to live on the earth, had dry land as such been there, the bird would not have returned. He sends out the dove again, it doesn't come back, and so he knows that the time is up and that it's ready to leave. He gets out of the ark. He offers up a sacrifice to God. God accepts the sacrifice from him and promises never again to bring a mabul or a flood upon the earth. Then we read the commandment about eating meat. Meat is permitted. Blood is not permitted. Murder is absolutely forbidden. God gives his blessing to Noah and his children. And then the sign of the rainbow, which is the promise never again to destroy the world. Well, that's very basically it. Incidentally, our rabbis did not understand this portion as meaning that the flood inundated the entire universe, the entire world. That as far as the information we can gain, the flood affected merely the civilized portions, the then civilized portions of the Near East. It does not necessarily mean that the flood went from one end of the world to the other and covered the entire face of the globe. There are several indirect references to this, some direct. The Talmud maintains time and again that it's only in Bavel where all the cataclysm occurred. Other rabbis maintain that Palestine was not affected by the flood. The Holy Land was not. So you see that the flood should be taken as a major cataclysm of the whole geographic area, but it need not necessarily mean that the whole world was destroyed by the flood. Now, what are the general ideas we get out of this whole description. Well, what does the Torah want to teach us here? Several things. Remember again that, and this will come to later on, that implicit in all this, the Torah is read on several levels. The Torah speaks not only to us and to all generations, it spoke also to that generation in which the Torah was received. And to them, this had a special meaning, which we'll see a little later on, in which the Torah meant implicitly to reject certain other stories that people were aware of, certain other interpretations of the Great Flood. But as it stands, the Torah, for us and for them, for that generation and for all generations, the Torah has certain principles that it wants to teach in this narrative. Again, the lesson is implicit and not a direct moralization. What are some of them? Well, obviously, what is the first? What is the primary motif? Justice. A world is bad, is evil, God punishes them. God brings the flood on the earth. Why? Because they are evil. Why does God save this one family? Because they are good. In other words, it's a moral motif to all of it. Second, at the end, the idea that God keeps his word. He gives the blessing to Noah, which is almost verbatim the blessing that he gave to Adam, seeming to indicate that just as God promised Adam that he would have a blessing, that blessing could not have been kept had God destroyed all mankind. It would have meant that God reneged. But since God did save one family, there's a new start, that means that God did keep his word. It shows us that even in a time of Midas Hadin, even in a time when the divine severity reigns over earth, and there's destruction, cataclysm, catastrophe, still the Midas HaRachamim, God's love and compassion, is evident. If not in abundance, at least in some measure. Noah's sacrifice, you have a lesson of gratitude for having been saved. The idea that Noah did what God demanded of him, although he didn't understand everything, that Vayas Noach Kashasiva Ta'olakim, that he did what God demanded of him, emphasizes the element of discipline, of obedience to God in a disciplined manner. You have at the end the part I read before, the Torah's attitude towards letting blood, towards spilling blood. It's against spilling blood. Then you have the reverence for all of life, the fact that a special attempt was made to save all animals, and therefore that God's mercy extends not only to man, but to all living beings. Now, before we go to analyze the words of the Chumash, let's try to get a little comparison to some of the myths that were then prevalent, and which the Torah probably had in mind when it told this story, because at the same time that it speaks to the future, it speaks to the present, to those people who had these myths in the back of their mind. The story of the flood is known amongst almost all peoples. All primitive peoples knew of the flood. It couldn't have been a minor incident. It must have been a great cataclysm that caused it. If you want to understand the kind of myth towards which the Torah directed its story of Noah, the true story of Noah, and the way it tried to strip away all the accretions of paganism and mythology, then the story with which to compare the portion of Noah is the Mesopotamian, the Babylonian flood story, which comes to us in two versions. It comes to us in the version of the Shumari, the Sumerian, and the later version of the Akkadian. The Sumerian was discovered in 1914 through a particular archaeologist, and it was estimated then that we hold to it now that the Sumerian text was about 4,000 years old, which means not much after the flood. Perhaps how much? Perhaps 1,000 years later, or 800 years after the flood itself was reputed to have taken place. Second, after that, not much later in time than the 4,000 years ago, the Akkadian, which is also a Babylonian language and based upon the Sumerian story, came to us in much greater detail. These are the epics of Gilgamesh, the Gilgamesh tablets. On the 11th Luach, on the 11th tablet, was discovered the story of the flood, which elaborated the previous tablets of the Sumerian. Fascinating stories unfolded, and we discovered the whole Mesopotamian myth of the Mabul. Now, this is the story of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh is a great hero, a king, a Babylonian nobleman, let's say. And he sees a friend of his die, and suddenly he comes to fear death too. He fears death and he wants very much to gain immortality so he can conquer death. But how do you gain immortality? You become a god. So he goes to visit a man called Utnapishtim. Utnapishtim, as you'll soon discover, is the equivalent, the Babylonian equivalent of Noah. Utnapishtim once was a human being, now he's a god. He became a god through a story which you'll shortly hear. And he asks of him the secret of how he, Kaitu, can become a god and live forever. Utnapishtim discourages him and tells him that it's an almost impossible task, but he tells how what happened to him. This is the story that Utnapishtim tells. There was a council of gods, and one of the chief of those gods, and a very capricious fellow, who evidently suffered from a great deal of distemper, probably had chronic indigestion, was named Enlil. Enlil, when he saw that kihechel ha'adam larov al pnei ha'aretz, that mankind was increasing, became very disturbed because they made too much noise and they disturbed his sleep. Good a reason as any for a god to get angry. And so he got the other gods together and they decided that they were going to bring some kind of major disaster upon mankind so as to reduce their numbers and therefore reduce the noise. He decided to bring a mabul, a flood upon the earth and destroy mankind. But amongst the gods there was one called Ea, Aleph Aleph, Ea, E-A. Ea had a friend amongst human beings called Utnapishtim. He wanted to save him. But he's not allowed to tell him directly because he'd be violating the trust that binds all gods together. And so what does he do? He comes to Utnapishtim in a dream and says, leave your house and build a ship. Leave your house and build a ship. Leave your house and build a ship. And so Utnapishtim dutifully obeys his dream, leaves his house and begins to build his ship. During the course of this, Utnapishtim turns to Ea in the dream and says, but people will see me building such a tremendous ship, what am I going to tell them? He says, well, and here you have an interesting comment, we'll later try to analyze the meaning of it. He says, well, tell them that the Gishmei Tevu'ah, the Babylonian equivalent, Gishmei Tevu'ah, the heavy fall rains, harvest rains are coming. You see, and he fooled them because instead of Tevu'ah, it was Tevusa, which means flood rains. In Babylonian, similarly, a very slight lapse of a consonant, of a light consonant, is the difference between a harvest rain and a catastrophic rain, a flood rain. So in other words, his idea was, through a pun, a play on words, to fool his friends and to let them believe that he was only building it because it may be wet in the tent. Actually, he was building it because he wanted to escape destruction and did not want them to know what is happening. Well, the rains came. One of the gods locked him in, another of the gods who were friends of Ea gave bolts of lightning, another one gave thunder, another one brought blackness, and the other one brought rain from above, and the other rain from below. The whole council of gods, it was a division of labor in a sort of industrialized divine society. And finally, they found they had a Frankenstein on their hands. The flood got out of hand, and the gods were frightened. And they began to scurry from heaven to heaven until they reached the highest heaven because they were afraid of the flood. And there they huddled together until the flood began to recede. And when the flood receded and Utnapishtim left the ark, he offered up a sacrifice. And when he offered up the sacrifice, the gods pounced down because they were hungry and thirsty. They hadn't eaten all during the time of the flood. And in the words of the Gilgamesh epic, they surrounded the sacrifice, which means the meat that Utnapishtim had offered to them, like a bunch of flies, a swarm of zvuvim, of flies. And there they ate and drank vinochatinus. They were simply starved, and so they ate it. When Enlil saw that one man had survived, he was very angry. After all, he wanted to kill off these noisemakers. And here again is going to come mankind, and they're going to have a New Year's party, and the gods are going to be disturbed again. And so he's very upset, and after a serious debate in the heavenly council, it is decided that Enlil would sort of accept the realities of life, and so he goes to Utna Pishtim and his wife, who bow down, touches them on their foreheads, gives them a blessing, and declares that henceforth they will become gods, not merely human beings. You see, Enlil had a sly, devious idea in his head. He was going to give the other gods the satisfaction of knowing that he's not angry at them, but by making Utna Pishtim a god, he sort of makes sure that there are no men left. So he makes Utna Pishtim a god, and that's the story that Utna Pishtim tells of Gilgamesh as to how he became a god.
How was the human race upgraded?
Well, no kashas, I don't know. I don't know, unless Utna Pishtim had children with him, I don't know what the story is. But this is the, of course, we can't ask a question about this sort of thing. Now, there are similarities in the story that you've noticed yourself. I need not elaborate them. There's a flood, there's a warning, there's rain, there's a recession, they're sending out the birds, there is a sacrifice, and that's where it ends. The very fact that there's a similarity should lead us to realize the following. Number one, the fact that so many people had the story indicates that there must have been some kind of natural cause for it that deeply affected mankind, and that most civilized nations today, having come from that area, all of them brought some kind of story with them. Second, the similarity of the story would lend credence to the story itself, that there must have been some story that was known amongst many people as to how this one family escaped this terrible destruction. But the similarities really are very unimportant compared to the differences. Besides the differences of details, that the other story is incredible in its details, and the Torah story is credible. The other story has a ship so big that Queen Mary would look like a robot against it. The whole flood there is 7 days, which is incomprehensible. In 7 days you don't get a flood over the whole, over thousands of square miles. Other such things which are simply physically don't make sense. But look at the differences. What is the reason for the flood in the Babylonian myth, and what are the reasons for the flood in the Torah? How do you compare them? Here they make noise and disturb the gods. And what is the reason here? Chamas, evil. So man is destroyed not because he disturbed the gods, but because he was immoral. He was bad.
Disturb the gods in a different way.
Of course you want to listen to just a play on words, but it's more than simply making too much noise. He doesn't let the gods sleep. He doesn't disturb the gods' sleep, you see. He disturbs God's sense of rightness, which is a vast difference. Utna Pishtim is saved because he has an in with one of the gods. He's a friend. He simply saved a friend. It's a capricious act. Noach is saved because it was Ish Tzadik, Tamim Hoya Baderosa Veselakim is Halach Noach. Yes, but look at the first two parts, you see what it means by being a pal of God. A pal means he was a justice man, a righteous man. Again, there's a moral reason, it's not merely a caprice. In the Mabel, in the Babylonian story, how do the gods react to the flood? They're afraid, they scurry away like a pack of mice. In the Torah, chas v'chalila, God is the Lord of nature. He brings the flood, he makes the flood recede. He is over nature, he transcends nature itself. To say that God is afraid of the flood would be an absurdity in the framework of the Torah. In the Gilgamesh epic, you have the story of gods disagreeing and fighting amongst themselves. In the Torah, no such thing. There is only one will of one, absolutely one God. Very important. In the Gilgamesh story, what happens when the sacrifice is offered? They run, they eat, they're hungry, the gods eat it. What about the story of Noah? Let's turn to page, where is it? Page 12, is it? 12, on bottom, verse 20, verse Chaf. Va'even Noach mizbeach la'Hashem, he builds a mizbeach, an altar, he brings a very pure, every clean animal, and every clean bird, and he offers up, what does he offer up in the mizbeach? What is an ola? What is a burnt offering? The whole thing is destroyed. There is no meat left that can be consumed. In other words, everything is burned to a cinder. Nothing is left. And God smells the sweet savor. And what does God do? Does he eat? Does he drink? Of course, if he wanted to, could he? There's nothing left. So you see what happens? The Torah, many people will point to you and say, well, if you look at the story of Noah and you see that God smells the sweet savor, you see it's primitive, it's anthropomorphic. Sure, speaking to 20th century man, it sounds primitive. But the Torah wasn't addressing only us, the Torah was addressing all generations. And in that generation, this was a very powerful thing. This told indirectly the Jew that don't absorb these silly stories of your environment. What they believe that the gods ate? No. The Rabbanu Shalom smell, which is maybe an anthropomorphic expression but should not be taken literally, but indicates this, that is smelling a physical process? Is it mamish? Is it substantial? No. It's ethereal. It means God was pleased. Because if God really had to have it, then I'm sure that after being starved, he didn't have to have a whiff of tabak, a snuff of tobacco, he had to have some good solid food. But God's smells indicates he doesn't have to have food. So on the contrary, it's a reaction against the primitivistic ideas entertained by other peoples. It was a carbon ola, it was a burnt offering. There was no kind of food offered to a god, kaviyachol. So that on the contrary, this story, if anything, is a reaction against a pagan notion, not a vestige of it. If you understand it in this framework.
The question that seemed to arise is that, did this really happen as the way the Torah describes it, or is it simply an endeavor to counter a myth which would have unsavory?
Well, there are those who say it's counter a myth. We absolutely reject it. I think the Torah had many myths it could have countered. Why did it pick on this myth? You say the flood story was important? Well, thousands of stories are prevalent. I think that the story of Noah did occur. And those aspects of the story which the Torah mentions, after all, the Torah couldn't mention every detail. We read that the story of Cain and Hevel was in four sentences. Here it's much more. Why? Because the details that the Torah chooses to tell you about in the story, the Torah picks significant details. Significant for that generation and significant for all generations. So if the Torah tells you, for instance, the story of smelling the sacrifice, the Torah could have told you the first words that Noah said when he came out into the open, and he thanked God in certain words perhaps, but that wasn't important. What was important for educational purpose was to say what happened, that there was no hungry God waiting to eat at the mercy of mankind, at the mercy of this one man. So the story happened. The details chosen to commit to all time are the significant ones.
And these details themselves happened. In other words, not the general story, but the details.
Oh yes, I'm convinced. The details specifically happened. There are many details we don't know about that weren't given because they were not pertinent. These were pertinent, for one reason or another. So, further, what happens in the Babylonian myth to their Noach, to Utna Pishtim, after after the story of the flood is over? He becomes what? He becomes a god. Let's see what happens to Noach. Page 14, verse 20. And Noah, who was a husbandman, a farmer, began his work and he planted a vineyard, and he gets drunk. A god? Not quite. He's simply an Isha Adama. He simply is a farmer. Why does the Torah have to tell you that he was a farmer? Does the Torah have anything against farmers? Perhaps specifically to tell you that Noah wasn't a god. He was a righteous man, period. And no man, however righteous he is, can ever aspire to become a god. Again, it's true that after Noah got out, he got back to work to be misasik, be yeshuva shalom, to simply get civilization started again. Why does the Torah have to mention this specifically? Adama, not Shemayim. Torah wanted to stress to you these facts, which otherwise might have caused error amongst people who were acquainted with other versions of the story. And during the time, just going back a step, during the time, this we mentioned before, that Utna Pishtim was building the ark, what was his attitude towards his fellow people, fellow human beings? He kept it a secret, because he had to keep a secret for the god. And the Torah, do you know what the Gemara says? The Talmud says, why did it take 120 years to build? Precisely. So that Noah should have a chance to preach to the people. He didn't do it, or he wasn't successful, it's another story. But people should see, they should ask, and Noah should tell them there's going to be a mubble. Save yourselves while you can by your good behavior. The whole emphasis is vastly different. And this shows you the quality of Yiddishkeit and the quality of Torah, and the quality that Torah wants to teach us thereby. So through a comparison and a contrast with an ancient myth, you can begin to appreciate what the Torah is trying to tell us for all times. To concern ourselves with other people, to keep the ethical motif of tzedek paramount, to have an attitude towards the Ribono Shel Olam which is not anthropomorphic, to know that righteousness does not make a god out of one, you can't be a magician in a sense, that you have to keep within human limits, but never sink below human limits. So that the whole story assumes a different significance in this particular matter, in this particular way. Well, let's try to go now to each individual word. Eileh told us, Noah, we're on page 9. These are the generations of Noah. The generations of Noah means the times in which Noah lived. Perhaps the word toldos means the stories of Noah. This is the story of Noah. Noach ish tzadik tamim hayor bedorosav. He was a righteous man. He was whole or perfect in his generation. Esther Elohim hisalech Noach. Noach went or walked with God. Just to mention this because it's so famous, let me read to you the Rashi and Bedorosav. Rashi quoting the Talmud says, what does it mean Noach was tamim, a righteous man in his generations? Because Yesh Mirabosenu Darshimoso Leshevach. Others interpret this as a special commendation for Noah. That Kol Shekein She'ilu Hoya Bedorot Tzadikim Hoya Tzadik Yosef. If he was able to remain a tzaddik in this terrible generation and not conform to them, he certainly would have remained a tzaddik in a better generation. A man who can live with a Dor HaMabul and still retain his integrity would probably be a saint if he lived in a more normal society. Others interpret it as a slur on Noah, that he was a righteous man but not too righteous. In what sense? The Fidoro Hoya Tzaddik. Relative to his generation, he was righteous too. But had he lived in the generation of Abraham, he would have been a sinner, not a saint. So that it gives you two ways of looking at people, incidentally. Looking at any person who is regarded as above his level in society. Number one, you can say, compared to other people, he's great. But on an absolute basis, he's nothing. On the other hand, you consider the influence they have on him. If he can survive somewhat intact in this kind of culture, then he certainly would be great if he had a better environment to spur him on. Very interesting is the explanation of the Klei Yakar. How many praises do we have of Noach in this first verse?
Three,
right? That's why I had three times Noach in one sentence. Noach ish tzadik. He was ish tzadik. He was a righteous man, yes? Second is, what is the second praise? Tamim hayar bedarosav. He was righteous, or how does he translate? Whole, perfect, in his generation. Or his generations. Third, Noah walked with God. Why these three praises? Why isn't it enough to say Noah ish tzadik hayah? Period. Or one of the other two. The Klei Yakar explains in a beautiful way. What was the sin of this generation according to our rabbis? three sins primarily. There was gezel, robbery. There was gilui arayos, there was immorality. And there was avodah zarah, idolatry. So the Torah wants to tell you, by describing Noah, that he refrained from any of these three sins. He was ish tzaddik. The word tzaddik comes from tzedek, justice. He never took what did not belong to him. He refrained from gezel. Tamim haya bedorosav. He was perfect in his doros. What does generations mean? A generation involves the generations he begat, that he was the father of. In other words, in his sexual relations, he was tamim. He was wholehearted. He was clear. He was clean. So that he was not affected by or infected by immorality, by gilui arayos. Finally, Esa Elokim Hishalach Noach. Noach walked with God, not with Elohim Echer, not with other gods. So in these three descriptions, you have the obverse of the three sins that were prevalent in that generation. I just noticed it this evening in looking over the Kli Yakar. I think it's a very, very beautiful and very valid interpretation of this one verse, and shows incidentally that the interpretation of the rabbis as to the sin of that generation, Yeshla Amal Lismoch, it has validity, it's one of great insight. Now, Esa Elokim Hishalach Noach, Noach walked with the Lord. There's a Rashi here that I find puzzling. Perhaps you can help me in it. It's a famous Rashi. Rashi says as follows. Noach walked with God, Esa Elokim. Uva Avraham hu omer, what does it say with Avraham? Asher Hishalachti Lefanov. God whom I walked before. God, he said, was Hishalach Lefanai. God told Abraham to walk before him. So Noah walked with him, and Abraham walked before God. Why the difference in idiom? So Rashi says, Noah hayot tzorech sa'ad letomcho. Noah had to have support. He had to have something to lean upon. He leaned upon God. He walked with God and sort of leaned against God as he walked. But Abraham hayot mischazek u'mahalech b'tzidkasa mi'olav. Abraham walked under his own steam. He walked before God. Now, what does Rashi mean, and why do you think I'm puzzled? Why would you be a little puzzled by this? First, what do you think Rashi means? It seems to me the significance is if you take Rashi literally, unless I'm misinterpreting him, I take Rashi to mean that, after all, what he says is that Noah walked with God, that without the command of God, Noah would not have been a righteous person. He would not have known what to do. But Abraham had a strong moral, ethical urge, and that he could have gotten along without a specific revelation. That is one way of interpreting Rashi. Noah walked with God, he walked before God, which would indicate that there are two areas of morals, two areas of good deeds in existence. One is what later philosophers called natural law. In other words, that aspect of morality that man knows naturally, spontaneously. We know that we ought not to kill, even if we don't study the Torah and read Lo Tirzach. We know that we oughtn't to steal, even if we don't read Lo Tignovu. We know we can't commit adultery even without close enough. These things aren't part of man's natural moral makeup. And there are those aspects which are not part of his natural law, but which come specifically by revelation. For instance, to make Kiddush on Shabbos. No one would ever invent it if it didn't say it in the Torah. To eat matzah on Pesach, to eat maror on Pesach, not to eat chametz, things of this sort. It would seem from Rashi that Rashi regards it as a greater virtue if man comes by himself to moral understanding than if he comes to the moral act or the moral insight as a result of religious command, a divine command. Well, that's a problem. You know, this is a problem which was debated very seriously throughout all of the scholastic tradition of the Middle Ages. by all people of all religions, especially the Muslims, and they have some very brilliant thinkers. Which comes first? Does God command the law because the law is good, or is the law good because God commanded it? This was in serious debate, and as if part of the philosophy of law, between the two, the Ash'ariyya and the Jabariyya, and the two famous Islamic schools of thought in the very early Middle Ages, in the 8th and 9th century, the beginning of the medieval period.
It's almost Platonic, isn't it?
Almost, but not quite. I mean, it didn't split clearly along those lines. In other words, the problem was, which does God command something because it's good, in which case? The good is absolute and God merely responds to it? Or is there no such a thing as good and evil in itself?
But then everything that God would do is capricious, since he himself doesn't have a standard.
Precisely. It's capricious in the sense that God's will determines what is good and what is bad. If you want to know what is good and what is bad, you simply look at what God commanded.
And that could be capricious. I mean, good one day could be bad the next day.
No, but we assume then we would have no standard of good and evil at any time. We assume consistency by God. When God commands, it's a consistent command. But does that determine what is good? Or is the reason for God's determining it that was good? The Rambam explains it this way. He says, the problem in debate is the divine command, the mitzvah, a result of chokhmas habore or ritzon habore, God's wisdom or God's will? What does it mean? If it's God's wisdom, it's because God had a good reason. Since this is good, I'm going to command it. That's wisdom. If you say will, it's because I will it. It's capricious. And therefore, since I willed it, it becomes good later on. Which is it more? Chachma, which means there's a motive, there's a reason, and it is God commanded it because it's good, that God allows us to set objective standards and absolute standards of good and evil, and he orders us to follow them? Or is there no such thing as wisdom? That God works only by will? Of course, Maimonides says ultimately both are one. But still, there's a problem of how to define them. Sa'adya divides, Sa'adya gives one solution, in which he says that there is a division. There are revelational laws, and there are natural laws, rational laws. In other words, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kidnap, thou shalt not do other such things. These are natural laws. God commanded them simply to reinforce them. There are others that are not rational, and where the good depends upon the divine command. But from Rashi, what would it seem? Which of these is preferable, the natural or the revelational?
The natural.
It would seem that it's preferable. What bothers me is that somehow Rashi lives in that kind of environment where he shouldn't have said this. If Sa'adya said it somewhat, and Rambam said it more, that's all right. But I personally am puzzled because the whole mood and environment in which Rashi moved should have been counter to this.
But Rashi didn't go with this people.
Oh no, but this is clearly what he says. But I think it's because of this reason that the Sifsei Chachamim gives a different interpretation to Rashi.
Maybe it's because Rashi looked at Tamim Ayala Galatam and could have said that he fulfilled, he was whole in the tradition that was handed down to him through his Kabbalah. In other words, his family was traditional.
No, but he works on the pasuk of Et Alekim Et Alech Noach.
Yes, this would explain that Tamim Ayala Galatam. It would mean that what does it mean to say he was whole with his generation? Because he walked with God. In other words, but he gave substance to his belief only because he had it as a tradition.
Yeah, how about Abraham?
Abraham didn't. His father was...
But you know who Noah's father was? Lamech. Some tradition. Some father. I don't think he was much an improvement of a Terach. But you know, the Sifsei Chachamim, the commentator on Rashi, you know, we have commentaries on commentaries on commentaries, and on them someone writes a commentary. The Sifsei Chachamim on Rashi interprets Rashi differently. He says that when Rashi says that Noach needed support and couldn't get along by himself, and Avram did not, that Rashi meant this, that Noach was not a full-fledged tzaddik. And here he accepts the one of the two previous opinions, that Noach was a tzaddik only relative to the kind of people he lived with. But in an absolute sense, he was no great sheikhs. That being only a sort of half-boiled tzaddik, he did not have within himself the strength to transform his environment. He was only strong enough not to allow them to transform him. He did not have that creative power to work on them and make mention out of them. He had to rely upon God. He leaned on God. In other words, as far as he was concerned, there were two beings in the world, him and God. He ignored the rest of society. He simply was afraid to have any contact or communication with them, because instead of him converting them, they would convert him. With Abraham, he walked before God. He cleared the way. He cleared the way for God. He was a prophet. Not only didn't he allow his society to affect him, he took it as his sacred duty to convert his society, which he did. That's what he's famous for. This is HaNefesh Asher Asa B'Choron. He insisted upon going out into the world, meeting them, and transforming them. And that is what Rashi means, that Noah had to have support, he had to lean on God. He had no one else. Abraham walked before God in his own righteousness, which means he took his godliness and didn't stay only with God, but prepare the world for God who's going to follow him.
So therefore, the prior problem falls.
That's right. Precisely. That's why I maintain the Sifrei Chachamim went out of his way to explain Rashi, because I believe that the Sifrei Chachamim may have been bothered by the same problem that bothered me, that this doesn't strike me as altogether the pure Jewish idea that Rashi should have entertained. You see, I'm convinced, as perhaps a number of others are or are not, that we had two great schools in medieval days, the Franco-German school, which were very unphilosophic, but Talmudists all the way through, and the Spanish school, who in addition to being Talmudists were poets and grammarians and philosophers and mathematicians, medical doctors, where you have a difference, a divergence of points of view. It seems to me that the authentic point of view will be found amongst the German school and French school, not amongst the Spaniards. The unphilosophic Jewish sages were always closer to the whole stream of the Talmud and the Bible than were those who were affected by Greek thought, who already had a bug in them and who sometimes were not able to discern very clearly between the Greek rationalist trend and the completely authentically Jewish one. Not in all cases, but I think in most cases.
Wasn't Halevi Spanish?
Yes, but Halevi was a reaction against the Greeks. He was anti-philosophic.
Otherwise, he wouldn't rightly belong to the Spanish school, as you call it.
No, he was a reaction against them. He also was somewhat affected, but in a very half-hearted way. Primarily, he was a reaction against them. I would class him spiritually more with Rashi and the Ben Tam. Whereas Saadia, who was in Babylon, you class with the Spaniards already. You class him with Maimonides, with Ibn Ezra, with Ralbag and the others.
Wasn't Bachia also Spanish? Yet he too wasn't quite.
Well, we don't know much about Bachia. We know only Yeshovas Halavavos, where he concentrates only on the Chovas Halavavos, on the duties of the heart. We know only Hishar HaYichud, the first chapter of the book, which is frankly pretty much affected by Neoplatonism. All right, so Rambam was an Aristotelian. He was a Neoplatonist. Saadia was affected by the Mutter Kalaman. But still, they respond to outside pressures, which may be good. Perhaps for our day, the model may be Spain instead of Franco-Germany. But if you want to know where you find indigenous Jewish thought, amongst the unsophisticated, unsystematic Talmudic sages. That's where you really find Jewishness. There is inbred. There's a very strong protection against any outside alien influence. Now, what happened to Noah? Vayolad Noach Shlosha Bonim. He has three sons, Shem, Cham, and Yafes. This is not necessarily in the order of age. I think the oldest one would be Yafes, then Cham, then Shem. Probably in reverse order. Why the Torah mentions it this way, I frankly don't know. I haven't looked into it. But Shem became the father of the which people?
Semites.
The Semites. Where does the word Semites come from? Shem? Cham became the father of the Hamites. Do you know any Hamitic languages?
They're all in Africa today.
Of course, Ethiopic. Ethiopic is a Hamitic language. As a matter of fact, Hayal Selassie is related to Semitic. Hayal Shalishi. Hayal Shalishi. The third force.
The Trinity, he calls it, doesn't he?
What's that?
Doesn't he call it the power of the Trinity?
Yes. Yes. The power, Chayal, from, for instance, Yashar Chelech, or Michael Al-Khoyal. Power of Shalishi, of the third one. He almost became a Holy Ghost himself recently. And finally, Yofet, who is the father of the Western nations, or the Greeks. He's regarded as a prototype of the Greeks or the Western peoples. Vatishoches ha'aretz lefnei ha'alakim. And the world became corrupt. Before whom? For whom? God. Again, let me point out what the Kli Yakar says. That the word Elohim can be interpreted in two ways. What is the other way of saying Elohim? Elohim means what? God, and what else does it mean? The judges. In Mishpatim, you have it clearly that both parties, you will learn in the code, in the civil code, both parties to a certain dispute should present their case to Elohim. Does it mean to God? No, it means to the judge. The idea of power. El means power. So that here too the Kli Yakar says the interpretation is not that the earth became corrupt before God, but it came corrupt before the very noses of the judges. Because according to the Talmud, the corruption began with the judicial wing. The judges became corrupt first. They cheated. They accepted bribery. They began to cheat according to our tradition, not on big sums, but on little sums, on pochas v'sheva pruta, less than a penny. Because they knew that less than a penny, once the judgment is passed, it can no longer be revoked by a higher court. Yes, a magistrate's court, I say, can be appealed to a higher court. But on, what's that? Doesn't, not only doesn't pay, but on the halacha, pochas v'sheva pruta in the yotzes b'dayanim. You don't longer, once the decision is passed on such an insignificant amount, tantamount to today, $5 perhaps, or whatever it may be.
Small claims.
Once it's passed, there's no appeal. Well, then, pochas v'sheva pruta, before the days of great inflation, was small claims. That's where they started to cheat, because they knew they can get away with it. That was the beginning of the corruption of the world. Another thing, you be considering the weather tonight? Or lefnei Elohim, that the world became corrupt before the unjust justices. The whole idea, of course, is significant too. It means that corruption rarely begins with major crimes. Corruption generally begins by chipping away a little bit at a time. It always begins with the smaller things. You know, if you go out and announce that you're going to murder someone, everyone's against you. But if you go out and make him lose his job by a piece of slander, which means also you take away part of his life, if not of his life, at least his livelihood, which is just about the same thing, well, that's already excusable. So if you begin on the small things, it leads to the big things, which is what happens here, according to Chazal. You begin with pochas v'sheva pruta, with less than a penny's worth, and ultimately, vatishoches ha'oretz, the whole world becomes corrupt because of these very judges. So that these magistrates, you see, they're the cause of all infections in society. And so the world became filled with chamas. And what happened? Yes? All right, we'll explain chamas now. This is a long discussion. I don't know, thinking I might not start tonight, but it'll go a long way. Chamas, of course, is a difficult word. It's a difficult word. According to Rashi, who quotes the Gemara, the whole reason that God decreed the punishment of the Mabul for the world was because of chamas. Because of the sin called chamas. What does chamas mean exactly? Is a matter of controversy in Sanhedrin between Rabbi Yochanan and the Shlakish. You know that these two great teachers lived in Jerusalem, or not in Jerusalem, but in Palestine. Oh, they lived the time of Rav, which means Well, does anyone know his history? Well, I have no memory for dates. Third century. The Bar Kokhba rebellion was in 100-something, which means Rabbi Akiva. This is three generations later. Year 212, Rav came to Bavel about that time. Third century. They were brothers-in-law. Rabbi Yochanan and Shakash were brothers-in-law. So it will be important in a few moments when I try to develop the idea. What is Rabbi Yochanan? Now these two are controversialists, very strong controversialists throughout the Talmudic period. Rabbi Yochanan says that chamos means gezel, robbery, plain and simple. This is the narrow definition of chamos, the constricted definition. Rish Lakish says that it means all important sins, all averis. It means insulting people, it means hurting people, it means lashon hara, everything. It means it was a general corruption. He gives a broad definition to chamos. Now, in order to understand the difference between these two interpretations, and here I'm giving you something that Rabbi Soloveitchik says, you've got to understand the relationship of Rabbi Yochanan of the Shlokesh and their characters, their backgrounds. He maintains that these two definitions are not matters of philology or etymology or grammar, but they stem from the whole world outlook and the experience, the personal biographical experience of each of these two sages. Rabbi Yochanan was mibetan amileide from the very beginning, a great saint and a great sage. Reish Lakish, who subsequently became his brother-in-law, what was his profession? He was an armed robber. He was a hoodlum.
Brigand.
Huh?
Brigand.
A brigand, that's the word for it, a brigand. You know how they met, I suppose, that Rabbi Yochanan was bathing, and from the distance Reish Lakish saw him and thought he was a woman, because Rabbi Yochanan was very fair, and so with great strength he dived towards him with a tremendous leap, tremendous show of power. When Rabbi Yochanan saw this, he said to him, "Chelech le'oraisa, such power should be used for Torah, not for your designs." And he said, "Really?" And they got into a conversation. He says, "Yes." He says, "I'll promise you my sister's hand in marriage if you will become a Talmud Chacham." And he did. And he became a Talmud Chacham, and he married his sister. And he became the controversialist of his brother-in-law, and perhaps, together with his brother-in-law, the most eminent sage of the day. Reish Lakish, Reb Shimon Lakish, was almost every page of the Talmud you find his name mentioned. So that Reish Lakish was an armed robber, a brigand. There's an interesting tradition, though, that's quoted in the name of Rabbeinu Tam, the grandson of Rashi. And that is that before he became an armed robber, do you know what Reish Lakish was? A great rabbi. Fascinating. That Reish Lakish originally was one of the Gedolei HaMesora, one of the giants of the Jewish tradition. Then he became a thief. He left scholarship, left the yeshiva, left Judaism. He became a brigand. And then when Rabbi Yochanan met him, he reconverted him back to Yiddishkeit. It would seem, therefore, that the Shlokish knew a little better than his brother-in-law what the word chamos means. He knew better than he did what it means for a righteous world to become corrupt. And when he said it means more than just stealing, he knew what he was talking about, because he was intimately acquainted with a kind of society where chamos is accepted as a standard practice and as a standard rule. Now let me divert for a moment. In the book Told Us Adam, a story is quoted about the Rambam, about Maimonides, that a Jew from Cairo came to him on Yom Kippur, who was known as a very pious man, and the man came to the Rambam and said, "I refuse to say the vidui, the al-chayt." He says, "Why do you refuse to say the vidui?" He said, "Well, here in the al-chayt, I have to say that I sinned because of so many things. I stole, I murdered, I committed sexual crimes. I never did. I didn't steal. I did murder this year. And I was moral this year. How can I say I did these things if I know I didn't?" A very, very balabatish question, a very plain, simple, direct question. And the Rambam, in answer, told him this story, which is quoted in the Talmud, in the Masechta Smachos. Fascinating story. The story is, I want to read to you the words. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, Rabbi Yishmael, Gozru aleyam leharev. The time of the martyrs at the Roman, at the hands of the Romans. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who was then the Nasi Sanhedrin, he was the president of Israel, the president of the court, which means the effective leader, political leader of the people, and also the great chief of the Sanhedrin. And Rabbi Yishmael, do you know what Rabbi Yishmael was? He was the Kohen Gadol, who was the high priest. They had decreed upon them that they'd be martyred, they'd be killed. Rabbi Yishmael was much younger than Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, was an old, venerable sage. And as they went to the scaffold, Rabbi Yishmael began to weep. Amala Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon turned to his younger colleague and said, Avreich, young man, why do you cry? Another two steps, and you will be handed over into the bosom of the righteous of all ages. What are you crying? Shouldn't be an occasion for crying. You're being martyred, and you too will die a tzaddik and find yourself in the company of all the immortals. And said to him, Amaleis Rabbi Shmuel answered Rabbi Shimon, V'chi ani bocha ashanu neharogin? Do you think I'm really crying because we're going to be killed? We've got to be killed in Kiddush Hashem, then it's nothing to cry about. You go ahead to be killed b'simcha. I'm crying for a different reason. Ela al sha'anu neharogin kishovchei damim ukemechalei Shabbos. I feel that we're being killed as if we were just ordinary murderers being led to the scaffold, as if we were Mechalei Shabbos, as if we deserve this death because we violated Shabbos or because we murdered. He said, I feel that the execution that's now going to take place is not a dramatic one with all the glory of martyrdom. I have the feeling, he said, that this is merely a dreary, ignominious, shameful execution of two criminals for crimes that they deserved, that they committed, and therefore a punishment that they deserve. So what bothers me, he says, is I don't know why. I feel it, but I don't know why. I see we're being executed like criminals, and I don't know what I ever did to deserve this. So the older man, Rabbi Shimon, answered him and said, Rebbe, called him Rabbi, he said, Rebbe. And listen to the situation he describes, and you see the standard of morality of a Tana. Shema Soed Ha'isa, O Yoshen. Perhaps one afternoon you were at home and you were eating. Perhaps you were taking a nap in the afternoon. Uvos Loch Isha Lishol Al Nidosav Al Tumosav Taharasa. Perhaps some poor woman came to ask you a shayla, whether it's a shayla Nida, to Metahara, a shayla on the chicken, whatever it might be. Poor woman came to ask you a shayla. V'yomala HaShamash, and the servant said, sorry, gotta go back. The rabbi is sleeping, Yoshin Hu. Busy, he's eating now. Or what would we say in modern lingo? Rabbi's in conference, no time. All of us who are busy, or secretaries say we're in conference. We can be doing nothing at all, but we're in conference. Maybe that's what happened. And perhaps he said, this woman was a poor woman. Perhaps she was a lonely person in a lower class. Perhaps she felt at that moment a twang of pain, and thinking to herself, if I be the wife of so-and-so, who is a big shot in the community, he'd interrupt his meal and come and say hello. Or he'd get up and say, yes, for me you have, for her he'd have time. But for me, in my condition, because I married poor, because we don't have money, because a thing of this sort, for me he has no time. For me he's not home. For me he won't bother because I'm not significant. I have no status. I'm not there amongst the 400. And she felt even more hurt, more embarrassed, more insulted. She grieved, she wept in her heart because of this. And you know, he says to him, HaTorah Amra Kol Almana V'yosam Lo Sa'anan. The Torah says, do not persecute, do not oppress a widow or an orphan. And Im Ono Sa'ane Osa, if you will oppress, Maksiv Basrei, what is the next thing the Torah says? V'harakti eschem b'chorev, I'm going to kill you with a sword. The Vidatocha begins right afterwards. In other words, perhaps, and perhaps you sinned against some poor, unwittingly, you didn't mean to say anything, you didn't say anything at all. Your shamash, the secretary, the gaba there, he had instructions that if when you're eating, you can't be disturbed. When you're sleeping, you can't be disturbed. But she took it as a personal hurt, because she wasn't one of the mighty. And therefore, in a way, you oppressed her. You hurt her feelings. And because of that, The Torah says, "V'harakti yeschem b'cherev." Maybe this is the punishment you're receiving now for a crime that you may have thought was insignificant. In your eyes, it was insignificant. In the eyes of the victim, it was a tremendous crime, a tremendous, tremendous insult. So that what he told them, in other words, is to take a cheshbon hanefesh of his own past, to realize that persecution does not mean only to take away her bread, but also to embarrass a person. Or as the Rambam says, incidentally, lahalacha, that when the Torah says this negative commandment, a widow and an orphan shall thou not oppress, this doesn't mean only literally a widow or an orphan, but as the Rambam says it, kol shedato shvela, whoever feels shafel, whoever feels humble and meek and unworthy, is halachically in the category of an almana v'yasam. If you want to pick on somebody, pick on someone who feels proud and mighty. Them, if you want to have a fight with, it's okay. But to pick on anyone, man, woman, or child, who feels they don't have substance, they feel shafel. There's no word for it really in English, is there? They feel inferior. That person is a biblical commandment against hurting or embarrassing them in any way. And so he said to the same Jew from Cairo, from this story you find everything, you find your answer. That oppressing, thou shalt not oppress a widow and an orphan, means that if a poor woman who has a father and a mother and who has a husband and children came and you didn't even realize that she was there, but inadvertently, because of a custom you have, she felt bad, you deserve to die already for it. If this is the man of the high moral standards that you are, if you are a Rabbi Yishmael Kohen Gadol, then this for a man of your standing is a tremendous avera. He said the same thing to you. Of course you didn't commit adultery this year. But for a man of your standard, you kind of committed something like adultery in your mind. Of course you didn't murder. But what happens if you insulted someone in public? You know how our rabbis describe insult. How do we say to insult someone in public in Hebrew? In the Talmud? Hamal ben p'nei chavero baram. What does it mean literally? He causes a man's face to turn white, which means the blood drains from it in embarrassment. Well, you cause the man to spill his blood. In the narrow sense, murder means to plunge a knife into his heart and to see the blood drop out. In the broader sense, the more refined sense, ethical sense, what is murder? To cause the blood to drain from his face. To steal. What does the steal mean in the narrow legalistic definition? To take someone else's money. What would it mean without his knowledge? What would it mean in the higher ethical sense? What do our rabbis call stealing? Gnevas das. To fool someone. Examples. Why don't you come over to my house and have dinner with us when you know the man will never step across your threshold or he's going overseas tomorrow? You fool him. You make him think that you're his friend when you're not really his friend. What are you doing? What are you stealing from him? His friendship. You are stealing his friendship. This is Onoah's Dvarim. Onoah, this is fooling people with words. Flattery when you don't mean it. You're stealing his confidence. You're stealing his loyalty. This is an Avera Midrabanan, based on Lo Signo. The rabbis expanded every single law to show its higher ethical refinements, its more rarefied ramifications. This is a broader sense of the law. This is what he told them. When you say vidi al-chayt, you don't only mean for the narrow definition of that al-chayt. You mean for all the ramifications, for all the consequences of it, in the highest ethical sense that Judaism has developed from the Torah. So that's what the Rambam answered to this Jew from Cairo. In the same sense, you have the controversy between the Shlokish and Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, not being a thief himself, always having lived in this kind of society, well, chomos, he says, means if you steal. But the Shlokish, having been in the society and out of it and in again, having broken from Judaism to learn what the other life is like, and then having come back and therefore being able to see both societies from a proper perspective, appreciated that chomos is not only in its narrow sense stealing as such, but in its larger sense, it means every kind of avera that a man can possibly do. It means that a man who leaves the treasures that he does have steals from himself. A man, in other words, who does have the opportunity to study, let's say, and doesn't study Torah, He is stealing from himself, the same as Rish Lakish stole from himself when he left Torah to become a brigand. That a man who has the opportunity to give Torah to others, to children, to friends, and doesn't, steals from them. He withholds from them what rightfully belongs to them. The same as the Shakish Meir felt that his fellow Jews were withholding from him until Rabbi Yochanan came and extended to him the hand of friendship. So that the Shlokish had this broader definition because of his broader experience in all walks of life, including that shady area where all of us are non-expert because we have had nothing to do with it, at least as far as I know. So this is the definition of Chumash according to Rabbi Yochanan and according to the Shlokish. All right, do we have a class next week? We decided to have a class, I believe, didn't we? Will you all be here? I mean, I want to. There are no. January what? What is the date? The 5th or the 4th? 5th? No. The 5th. Okay, then, so we'll try to be here on time. We'll be able to get started. And I hope next week, Yemi Hashem, to cover the last. I want to cover the story of the birds. It's an intriguing story with the birds. It's really. Maybe we'll invite Mr. Stern to be here next week too. The story with the birds, then the rainbow, murder, and we'll try to finish as much of Noach as we can, so that either after Purim or next year, however the case is, wherever we begin next, in other words, we'll be able to begin with Avraham Avinu.